Are you looking for your next adventure where you can have a meaningful impact? Come explore British Columbia with the help of HealthMatch BC. We're a free health professional recruitment service funded by the Government of British Columbia. We're currently recruiting rural physicians of all specialties on behalf of BC's publicly funded health employers. Visit us at healthmatchbc.org/rural for more information.
Hi, I'm Mojola Omale.
I'm Blair Brigham. This is a CMAJ podcast. So, Jola, today we get to talk about a controversy. Maybe it's not controversial. I think it's controversial, but maybe I'm just biased. We're talking about virtual care today and its impact on both family medicine and emergency medicine and the rest of us. You've had a transition to some virtual care. How does virtual care change surgical practice?
I feel like it depends on who you ask. A lot of other surgeons, they love it because now they get paid for what they were doing already. A lot of, you know, specialties, they were calling their patients anyways with their results. So that hasn't changed much. For me, from when I look at it from an equity lens, it makes sense that we have some aspect of that virtual care integrated into our healthcare because, you know, for follow-up of tests, renewal of prescriptions, I don't necessarily need to see you for that. A conversation over the phone is fine.
Yeah, it used to be that you had to go into an office or a clinic just for like a 30-second interaction to get an update on something or, you know, that was just a huge waste of people's time. And for some people, it would have been a substantial hardship. But at the same time, I guess there's a lot of conjecture and question about whether virtual care is, quote unquote, as good as in-person care. Certainly, there's been a lot of emergency physicians who feel that we've been seeing a lot of family medicine patients who might not have been seen otherwise had they had better access to their family doctors. But we're probably conflating that with people who either don't have a family doctor or choose to use walk-in clinics because they're closer to home or more convenient. But certainly a lot of chatter about whether virtual care has helped or hindered the overall state of the healthcare system. And we're going to get into it today.
Yeah, for sure. And this paper that we're looking at, it is a research paper, and we're going to speak to one of the core authors, Dr. Hemant Shah. The paper looks at, has there been an increase in emergency room visits with patients now that we have virtual care? And they look specifically at patients who had an established relationship with their family physician. And it's really interesting, the results of it. We're also going to talk about another fundamental question that we're going to explore is from the patient perspective, because we have been hearing a lot from patients who felt as if they had less access to their doctor during the height of the pandemic, although you could argue that we're still in the height of the pandemic. So I'm not sure what that means. And we're talking to Toni Lehman. She's the chair of the CMA's Patient Voice Working Group to talk about the patient's perspective on virtual care.
Let's go ahead and jump right into it and talk to our expert before we get to our patient. Dr. Hemant Shah is a co-author of the research paper in CMAJ looking at the association between the increased use of virtual care and emergency department use during the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic in Ontario. He's an internal medicine physician and hepatologist at Toronto General Hospital. Hemant, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. Great to be here to talk about this controversial topic.
To say the least. So you're an internist and hepatologist at one of the best hospitals in the world. What made you want to look into this topic around primary care versus emergency department care utilization?
Yeah, it's a great question. So part of my non-academic life is spent as a physician advocate and leader. And this was work that actually came out of my role on the Ontario Medical Association Negotiations Task Force, where I served as vice chair for our last physician services agreement negotiations round. That negotiations round took place through the COVID pandemic.
Right.
And as you might imagine, we went in with a plan about the priority topics for physicians that we were going to be negotiating with the ministry. And then the pandemic hit. And virtual care and its use, appropriateness, quality, payment structure, all of that became very, very important and central to our negotiations. So one of the great things about being part of a negotiations team at the OMA is we have a very analytic approach to everything we do. We have access to an enormous data warehouse, and we ask a lot of questions, research questions, really, about things that are happening on the ground in the practice of medicine in Ontario. And so we were diving very deeply into this issue around virtual care, because you may remember this. There were a lot of media articles early on in the pandemic about how people can no longer see their doctors in person. And as a result, they were going to the emergency rooms. I mean, I think many of our emergency physician colleagues were quoted in some of the papers.
We certainly felt that crush. We had people coming saying, I can't see anyone else. I'm sorry I'm here. I just didn't know where else to go.
Right. And we were hearing a lot of that at the negotiations table on both sides. And so we wanted to actually understand whether this was true or not, and whether there were certain types of virtual care that didn't result in increased emergency department utilization.
Okay.
So we began looking at this issue in the context of negotiations. And as we dove deeply into it, it became obvious that we were exploring something that was relatively novel and worth disseminating. And as an academic physician, and I have other colleagues that were on that negotiations team on the physician side who are academics, we thought this has to get out there and be published. And that's what really led us to ask this question.
So what was it that made you suspicious that those frontline reports from the ER might not have been reflective of the whole picture?
Well, what made us suspicious that part of the picture was being missed is that virtual care happens in many different contexts.
Sure.
So there's episodic virtual care. Many of us may have had this through the last couple of years with a physician or a healthcare worker that you don't have a continuous relationship with. That's one type of virtual care. And I think when people think about virtual care, that's often where their mind goes. You know, the idea that you go onto your phone.
Yeah.
Click on an app and some person pops up on the screen that you have a healthcare encounter with. But there's a lot of other virtual care that happens in the system. And there have been papers published in the CMAJ itself about this, which is virtual care that happens within the context of a continuous patient-physician relationship.
Like your surgeon following up with you or your family doctor checking in with you.
Absolutely. And the specific population we looked at in this study was patients in Ontario enrolled to family physicians. So these were their family physicians, and they were getting virtual care from their own doctor. And we wanted to understand whether virtual care in that context actually increased emergency department utilization.
So I want to pay attention to the nuance here. So let's talk about patients who have a family doctor who are getting virtual care from their family doctor. What did you find in that group of people? First of all, before the pandemic, how many family doctors were doing that with their patients?
So prior to the pandemic in Ontario, and I know the most about Ontario's data, so I'll talk about that for the moment. Prior to the pandemic in Ontario, only 4% of family doctors in Ontario were giving any type of virtual care. And the total number of visits that were being performed virtually was well below 1%.
Okay.
In the initial months of the pandemic, there was like a 5,600% rise in the amount of virtual care. I mean, it's like we turned on a dime.
Quantify that a little differently for me. You know, you had almost no virtual care, and then you had...
And at its peak in the early part of the pandemic, about 80% of primary care visits were being delivered virtually in Ontario.
And these are, I just want to stay in the nuance here. These are family doctors with their patients, pre-existing therapeutic alliances that are being moved to a virtual platform.
Exactly. So Ontario has a lot of primary care that's delivered in what we call a patient enrollment model, which means the patient signs a form that says, this is my family doctor, and there's an established relationship there. And we can actually measure that at the level, we can measure and follow that at the level of the healthcare administrative data sets. So we looked at people who had an established relationship like that.
Okay. And staying in that category, when we say virtual, are we talking about video? Are we talking about phone? Are we talking about email?
So this study could only look at video and phone visits because that's what was being paid in Ontario. Nuance there, I like that you're talking about nuance because there's a further nuance here, which is the study period we looked at, there was actually no code that identified whether a visit was a video visit or a phone visit.
I see. Okay.
So we can't tell them apart in this study. However, I think based on everyone's knowledge of what was going on and experience at the time, the vast majority of these visits were phone. There was actually very little video. So think about this as a study, primarily of phone virtual care.
Okay. And so what did you find? How many people were going from the phone to the emergency department, for example?
Well, so we had two factors. We looked at the amount of virtual care happening in a practice, controlled for a number of factors related to the physician practice, patient complexity, and then the outcome, which was emergency department utilization. And what we actually found in our unadjusted analysis was there's an inverse relationship. The more virtual care a physician was doing, the less their patients were utilizing the emergency department.
Wow.
And when you corrected for complexity, in Canada, we use something called the CTAS scores. We corrected for that. So that has to do with how severe the presentation was when a person comes to the emergency room. When we corrected for all of those things, the relationship did not change, and it did not demonstrate that there was more ED utilization in practices that did more virtual care. So it actually looked like to us, when virtual care was delivered in the context of a continuous patient-physician relationship, it would not increase ED utilization. And in fact, it might decrease ED utilization. And you could hypothesize why that might be the case. People may be able to access their physicians better, the ones that know them, and solve issues before they get to the point where they end up in the emergency room. So there are some plausible explanations for why this observation was found. But
so in a way, this sort of uproots,
it was novel.
Yeah, this totally busts the myth, a myth that I would have believed that. Now, I'm not a family doctor, but I assume that it's hard to diagnose someone over the phone. It's hard to know if chest pain or shortness of breath is worrisome. And as an emergency doctor, I just know the value that I sort of place on being able to put a stethoscope on someone's chest or an echo probe on someone's chest and get a sense of what's actually happening. So I would just assume that family doctors would be inclined to say, you know what, someone needs to actually see you physically, lay hands on you, and figure out if you need additional tests. But that is not the case in what you found in Ontario with family doctors who already had a relationship with their patients, who were on the phone with them throughout the pandemic. It seems that those situations actually reduced ER utilization, or at least didn't increase it.
Well, I think what you're getting at is the appropriateness of virtual encounters. Where in our healthcare system is it appropriate that there is utilization of virtual care, whether it's phone or video? And look, I practice longitudinal chronic care. I would say that when a patient calls my office and asks to be seen, I have a bit of knowledge about that patient already, that person, what their health complaint is at triage, which may be me or someone else in the office. And I can make a determination, is that appropriate to be done virtually or not? And that is, to me, where virtual care fits into the system. Now, I'm a specialist, but family doctors have far more touch points with their patients. They understand and they know their patients very well. So when someone requests a virtual visit, I think they're actually able to determine, using their professional judgment, is it appropriate or not? And when virtual care episodes take place after that determination is made by a physician that knows you, it doesn't drive healthcare utilization. And I think that's a myth bust here.
Even though the data shows that this is not what people were feeling, but people still had their feelings. And there's still that perception that they were not able to access their family physician. And ER docs also felt that they were seeing more patients. So what explains that phenomenon that people were experiencing?
It's a great question. I don't know the answer. I think that one of the things we could not look at was whether episodic virtual care was driving ED utilization, whether people were clicking on an app, getting some advice, and then going to the emergency room anyways after getting that advice, telling the emergency room staff, I saw a doctor on video and I came into the emergency room anyways. That's something we couldn't look at because it's actually very difficult to untangle, based with the administrative data in Ontario, whether a person doesn't have a relationship with a physician.
Oh.
Because there are people who have relationships with physicians that don't sign the form. It's a minority, but it confounds any analysis of a group of people that don't have an enrollment into a physician model. So it's a lot harder population to study. Now, if you look at the literature more broadly, work that other people have done, yes, there is some evidence that episodic virtual care, and this work primarily predates the pandemic, that it does appear to increase healthcare utilization, whether it's just in-person visits in a clinic setting or in an emergency room. Again, that's something we couldn't look at in this study.
So certainly, I mean, the number of people in the ER these days who grab me by the wrist after I discharge them and say, will you please be my family doctor? Like, I can't find one. I need a family doctor. It's just heartbreaking. Like, I've never seen anything like that in residency. It's only been in the last year or so that people, they'll stop me in the hall. They'll say, oh, you seem nice. Will you be my mom's family doctor? It's just outrageous. So there's a lot of people who are still struggling to get that family doctor access. Is there any other data out there that can help us understand that population, the people who don't have a family doctor, and how virtual care might help or hinder their efforts?
It's a great question. My wife is a family doctor.
And Does she have any space?
Completely hear what you're saying.
My mom needs a family doctor.
I've got a list of people.
My mom needs a family doctor, so if she has any space, please let me know.
I might have a family doctor for your mom.
We'll have to edit that part out, though.
Yeah. Like I said, we couldn't study this other kind of way that virtual care is delivered. I think there is a role for it in a healthcare system for people who can't otherwise access comprehensive primary care. But it cannot be the substitute for comprehensive primary care. I think everyone deserves a primary care provider who provides comprehensive care, ideally as part of a team, and works with other healthcare providers. That is the gold standard for healthcare for the population.
Right. So, and I want to go back to that population and ask another question about your data. Is it possible that although the number of visits to an emergency department didn't go up with increased virtual care, is it possible, and again, this is the eMERGE doc bias in me, that when people did have to come to the ER, they were sicker because they hadn't been examined in person for a while? So even though the absolute numbers weren't up, the acuity was higher, the complexity was higher. I think all of us in the ER right now are just feeling crushed by the sheer complexity of the patients presenting. They're so sick. They don't have formal diagnoses, but I know they've got COPD, and I know they've got heart failure, and I know they've got uncontrolled diabetes just by meeting them. Is there any sense that things went off the rails in that regard, that people, maybe they weren't coming as often, but when they did show up, man, there was a lot of stuff that needed to get tuned up?
So you should be a reviewer for the CMAJ, because this is this is a question that one of the reviewers asked us, and it prompted us to do another analysis where we actually looked at the CTAS scores that patients were presenting with to the emergency room. So it's not perfect, but it gets at this question of whether people were presenting sicker, even though they were attending less often. And we saw no difference when you looked at the CTAS scores for severity of the way people were presenting before and after the study period started.
What about admission rates?
So as far as we can tell that the severity of presentation hadn't changed. We did not look at admission rates. We don't have that data, unfortunately.
I guess we keep attributing the reason why patients are coming in sicker to them not physically seeing a family doctor, but only talking on the phone. And I don't necessarily think that that's true, because even if someone has a lump, even if you felt it, you're still going to send them for imaging. Even if someone is telling you that every time they walk, they're having a hard time breathing, or this is happening, you're going to be, okay, well, you need more imaging. Right. So that, I guess that's just a little bit of my bias.
This is a really interesting discussion, because at the negotiations table, we talked a lot about the value of the physical exam in modern medicine.
Okay.
And at the outset, I said we were very analytical in our approach. We actually did a systematic review on our side. Now I wish I published that too. but it's a really interesting issue about what the role is of that in-person encounter in a system where there are such sophisticated tests that can aid you in diagnosis and management of patients. I think this is a very live issue, and one that our healthcare system is going to have to kind of address, especially in the advent of AI. If an AI can just order the echocardiogram, do you need a cardiologist. My best friend's a cardiologist. I hope he's not listening. But those are the issues that I think our healthcare system is going to have to address moving forward. And they're intersectional with virtual care.
If you put on both your leader hat and look at this from a system perspective and your academic hat with the data systems that we have, what's
a lot of hats you're asking me to wear?
I know. But give me your best guess. Like, what's the next priority here for us to try to understand? How do we advance this topic and settle down this bickering that's going on between various physician groups and healthcare organizations to advance virtual care? We know we need the right amount of virtual care without having these sort of one shot and done, go see the eMERGE doc anyways types of systems that have also been brought to light.
I think there, to me, are three issues. I would like to see the future of virtual care analysis and investigation dominated by. So the first is, what is appropriate virtual care? In what context does virtual care make sense in our healthcare system? The second is, what is a high quality virtual care encounter? Is that driven by the modality, whether it's video or phone or some other technology? Or are there other factors that would influence quality, and we have to embed those into the way virtual care is delivered? And the third one, a big one to me, is how does virtual care impact equity and access to the healthcare system?
Hey, Mint, you leave more questions than answers, which is exactly what we like on the podcast here. But clearly you've thought about this quite a bit, and I need to think about it more as well and really embrace the nuance. And you've painted a really nice picture of the different areas of virtual care. Virtual care itself is not one thing. It's many different things. It can be done with high quality and low quality. And so I think it's really interesting as we follow along to see how Canada's healthcare system adapts to this and how the pandemic's influence will accelerate the use of technology to make sure people get the care that they need when they need it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Hemant Shah is an internal medicine physician and hepatologist at Toronto General Hospital. Coming up after the break, we'll get a patient's perspective on virtual care.
Sometimes the solution to nutritional deficiencies doesn't have to be complicated. Milk contains 15 essential nutrients that can play a role in the prevention of chronic diseases, from heart attack and hypertension to type 2 diabetes, even some types of cancer. It's a simple prescription for prevention, rooted in evidence and proven over time. So maybe it's time to rethink milk. Simple, healthy. That's the science of milk.
We're going to turn now to what patients have to say about the increased use of virtual care. Toni Lehman is the patient voice chair for the CMA. She co-wrote the Virtual Care Companion for Patients, and she's a member of the CMA's Virtual Care Task Force. She's currently in St. John's, Newfoundland. Thank you so much for joining us, Toni.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's just start off. From a patient's perspective, is the increase in the use of virtual care a good thing overall?
I definitely think it's a good thing overall. What we really need to think about is in the context of what the patient needs it for. So ultimately, I think virtual care allows for greater accessibility when it's done correctly. So if more virtual care means more patients are accessing healthcare in the way that's right for them, then that's amazing. So in that way, I do view it as a really good thing.
So you're out in St. John's, Newfoundland, but you grew up in, I don't want to say it wrong, Port-au-Basque,
yeah.
Port-au-Basque.
Good job.
What's your experience with virtual care been?
Yeah, sure. So growing up in a rural community like Port-au-Basque, before COVID, there wasn't a lot of virtual care around. Essentially, if you needed access to healthcare that was more than a family doctor, it did require, and still does to a certain extent, require a lot of travel. So for example, growing up, I've always had to go see a dermatologist. And unfortunately, depending on that year of my life, the dermatologist could have been 2 hours away, could have been 6 to 8 hours away, or could have been 10 hours away. So I've done it all. Wow. So ultimately, there was one specific, I guess, story that I remember when I was growing up that I actually had to travel. It's approximately, depending on the weather, because that's another factor here, about 8 hours to see a dermatologist for about 5 minutes for them to say, here's your prescription renewal. Have a great day. So that's a lot of time. and money and effort and resources that I'm very lucky to have had to be able to attend, where virtual care, it would have been the perfect thing for that. So since, I must say, it's definitely improved. There's so much more virtual care being used now in Port of Ask and other rural communities, but it took a lot. It took COVID to get us there, unfortunately.
For sure. Yeah. And when you think about it, and also from your work with the working group, what constitutes as high quality virtual care?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because just because virtual care is there doesn't mean it's of great quality, unfortunately. So ultimately, from a patient's perspective, quality virtual care really just has the same, I guess, stipulations as quality in-person care. We just really want to be accessing the care that we need at the right time with the right provider. So high quality virtual care is really just when the care provider listens to the patient regarding what they need. And when that's virtual care and both parties agree, this is what we need, this is what's best for your care right now, and this is what's best for the patient's accessibility requirements, that is amazing, because everybody's listening to each other, everybody's supporting each other. And so ultimately, like, it's just listening to each other, which is sometimes like the big overview of what patients are always looking for in any of their care, is just being heard and collaboration, because it can't always be one-sided. You know, we need to make sure that the virtual care that people are receiving is the care that they need. So essentially not making it a requirement, but making it an option, and a really good option for patients, and making it accessible that way.
So there's one thing that I find that I'm a specialist, I'm a general surgeon, and oftentimes patient will come in and say, my family doctor sent me here and they didn't even examine me. They just talked over the phone and they sent me here. And sometimes I'm like, well, yeah, that makes sense, because you were going to see me anyway. So it's not going to change. Like, but I guess my question is, like, from a patient perspective, when should a physician prioritize seeing the patient in the clinic versus doing it virtually?
Yeah. So I think that sometimes we don't need those in-person visits and sometimes we do. But ultimately, patients, I like to call patients experts in their own health. And I know that's sometimes a bit of a different view of it, because you as physicians are the experts as well. But most of the time, patients...
No, I'm an expert in a disease process. I'm not an expert on you.
That's a really good way to think about it. So I think I really appreciate that. Thank you. And patients would appreciate that perspective. So ultimately, patients know intuitively when, you know, what's going on with their body, what they think needs to be seen in person. So sometimes, you know, if someone's really going through something and it's physically new to them, they're really going to want to be seen in person. So by requesting that from their physician and having that as an option is really beneficial to patients. Essentially, just knowing that the healthcare provider has a virtual option and an in-person option available. And, you know, it really helps when care providers are saying, what do you think would suit your needs for this appointment? Patients really just want that ability to choose. They really know what they want and they know what they need. So by having the option, I think it would really eliminate unnecessary in-person appointments as well as unnecessary virtual appointments.
So you were part of the team that co-wrote the Virtual Care Companion for Patients. What do you think they need to know about it to make it a positive experience?
What patients need to know about it?
What physicians need to know about it?
So I think what physicians need to know is that just like it's a learning process for physicians, it's also a learning process for patients. We're all learning how to access things online, on the phone. People are using very different platforms. So just being patient and also, but also being informative. So sometimes if you get a link, no matter who we are, to something new and we're like, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do here. You need that extra time to figure it out. So just being transparent about what's going to happen and then giving patients the resources they need to access the type of care you're providing ultimately. And just by physicians knowing that this kind of care companion is an option, that is something that they can provide patients. Like, it's a ready-made tool. Here you go. Here's some things, which really helps, because yeah, we all just need to realize that this is very new and it's so so scary sometimes when you're doing.
I can definitely imagine that.
Tony, you mentioned that this is sort of a new thing for a lot of us and we're all trying to navigate it. You've sat on the education subgroup for CMA's Task Force on Virtual Care. What do you think could be done to make that learning process easier so that we can all get into using virtual care more effectively and quickly going forward?
Yeah, we've come so far. People know about virtual care more. It's being integrated into medical learning more. But ultimately, one of the big things we talked about in the report is updating and incorporating competencies for virtual care for learners. So the things that they do need to be competent in to provide that care. So by having these updated, we're making sure that we're using the virtual care of the times and making sure that they're learning the correct things to provide the best top-notch virtual care they can. So a lot of times too, you know, when we think about as a patient, we do focus on what the patient needs, but patients are very supportive of what a physician needs. So essentially in this education working group, we really talked about supporting medical learners in the education that they're being provided about virtual care. So teaching medical learners how to use virtual care as tools for communication and relationship building with patients, and just making sure that they have experience with it. We wouldn't ever, you know, as a general surgeon say, here you go, let's do this surgery. You've never done it before. Have fun. So why should we do that with virtual care?
Honestly, there's so much on YouTube. I can teach you how to do a lot of surgeries.
You can do a tutorial.
Thank you so much, Tony. This has been really great.
Thank you both.
Tony Lehman is the patient voice chair for the CMA. She is in St. John's, Newfoundland.
All right, Jola. So there's clear-cut times when someone does not need to physically come and see a doctor.
Yes, I would say... okay, I'm going to say something that is probably controversial. Similar to what Hemant was saying is... I do think we have to have that conversation is how much do we need the physical exam in modern day medicine? You know, back in the day, in those days, they would diagnose like a bowel obstruction based on the clinical exam because they heard some sort of sloshing. I don't even remember this physical sign. I just remember something about a sloshing. But nowadays, I would never like, from my history, I'd be like, okay, that sounds like this. And then I'll get the imaging to confirm my diagnosis and also my physical exam.
But don't you think there's more to it than just a physical exam, though? Like, we've heard a lot about people who work from home and how companies, maybe that doesn't always work. Maybe company culture suffers. Maybe you don't have the same face-to-face interactions with people. Maybe just when you sit down face-to-face with a patient, you learn more about them, you communicate more, they tell you some more symptoms. I don't know. There's something about sitting down face to face, whether you're in healthcare or any other part of being a human being, where sometimes face to face just gets things done. Maybe you build a better rapport. They trust you more. I don't know.
I agree with you. I don't necessarily know how I would feel accessing certain mental health. I don't know how I would feel like if I had to go to my family doctor, who I love, that, you know, let's say I'm having some sort of changes in my mental health. I would find it probably a little harder to describe to her in detail over the phone. Whereas in person, I might be able to discuss it with her a little bit better. So I do, I completely hear that point. I think that part of this is having really frank conversations also with the public about, you know what, this is maybe not the correct use of virtual care, because sometimes patients want this for virtual care. And also discussing with physicians that actually this is not how you provide high quality care to patients if you don't do a physical exam for, like, you know, knee pain. I'm not sure. I just made that up.
Yeah. I think a really good point of Hemant was that there's a difference in certain types of virtual care, right? There's high quality virtual care. There's a nuance here. Not all virtual care belongs in the same bucket. And then the other thing that I really took away from Tony's interview was that patients want choice. They don't want to be told, you have to do this virtually, you have to do this in person. For some people, they're going to want to come in and see you. For other people, they're like, I don't have time for that, or that's not accessible to me. Can we just talk on the phone? And so matching up sort of whatever the evolving evidence says about where do you actually get best care versus what patients want versus what physicians can, you know, reasonably give in a strained system. All of these things are interacting. It's way more complicated than I appreciated 25 minutes ago.
For sure.
Once again, more questions than answers, but we've run out of time. That's going to be it for this week's podcast. Please remember to like or share wherever you download your audio. We'd love to get the message out there and get more people listening and joining in on the conversation. I'm Blair Bigham.
And I'm Mojola Mulley. Until next time, be well.